go with it.
Can I just say what we're doing here? We're talking about the future of online video, and I've circled number three, what hope for the original online video content. Would you agree that's sort of what we've been talking about?
Yeah.
So can I very quickly get you to introduce yourselves and then say what have we summarised here, that the complexities. I've made a few notes, but let's see if we can come down. So your name's David.
Dave Evans.
Dave Evans.
Ian Smith.
David Terra.
Oh my god! We've got the David table. The Dave table. Okay, what do you think we've, in our discussion in the last 40 minutes, we've sort of come summarised?
I think we've gone round a lot of houses, but what seems to be a common theme is I think we're all agreed video blogging isn't working. There's too much dross out there. I express the concern that finding the good stuff, and there is good stuff, is difficult. And I've talked probably too much about the difficulties I'd had having identified a need as I saw it, or a niche area and something I was passionate about, how difficult it was to actually get a product together when you're, as you said, producer, director, writer, editor. And in fact, my final stumbling block, you know, was actually getting the thing published on a timely basis. I wanted something that was promoting something that was going to be released on a Monday that I got hold of on a Saturday morning, and just trying to turn around a 10-minute show on a Saturday and Sunday at the weekend. A certain amount of pre-prep you can do, but I was falling over with different video providers. What else have we covered?
I think there are kind of three things that in particular we've talked about. Because one is the fact that the vast majority of content out there is rubbish, and it's because we're at the start of video blogging. Like if you turn the clock back 4 or 5 years, at the start of text blogging, when everyone jumps in to do it, but doesn't actually understand the basics and doesn't understand that actually creating a program needs a writer and an editor and a producer and all of the expertise to put together a good story, and the vast majority of people doing it don't know those basics. Another thing we talked about is this: the fact that there's all that stuff out there. It's really difficult to find and categorise what's there. There's no way of tagging what's the good stuff, or to pick out from a 67-minute video the good bit in the middle, and I don't know all of the topics covered in that 67-minute video. I only know maybe a summary of what it's all about. There might be some real gold nuggets in the middle of it, and there's no easy way of actually tagging those. And then the other thing that we talked about is actually the complexity of doing all this in terms of the technical side. And there's a real hassle in terms of converting video for different formats and where you host it and all that kind of stuff, which is a real struggle, even for people who are good at this.
Yeah. I think from my point of view, yes, there's a huge resource out there, and it's only going to get larger. Although we say most of it is rubbish, it's only your personal opinion, because what's rubbish to you is going to be absolutely essential to the next person, which is the good thing about it. The problem is you've got such a huge resource, is how do you find the content, and the reverse is how do you find the audience. And so I think there's got to be two things happen. One is that from the technical point of view, it's got to get a lot simpler to do that. And then from a social point of view, we have to have a way of communicating this amongst ourselves, so that the stuff we're interested in, which usually our friends are interested in as well, then gets out to the world and gets distributed.
Just to finish, yeah. I would say that if we knew the answer to how to find your audience, all the conventional broadcasters would be leaping on that knowledge.
Yeah.
And also, it's how to earn a living, which is what you were experiencing, Dave, isn't it? That you were saying, actually, if you are actually coming up with something that people are looking at, then how do you generate income from that? Because it has costs in itself, not only in terms of paying for uploading, whatever, but in personal time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cowfish.
Tony Hall.
Richard Galbraith.
Andy Coughlin.
Is television dying or evolving? And that was kind of a very open-ended question, so it inevitably went through to loads of different parts as well. But I guess the way I kind of concluded it in my mind, what we talked about was that, like, TV is as a broadcast medium, and having sort of something there which is produced as a high quality is always going to exist. But allowing people the option to start conversation around that, to collaborate around it, to have a community around it, is kind of the future evolution of that. Now, not everybody may get involved with that, because a lot of people, we also kind of decided that just like going and sitting in front of the television not thinking about anything else, but as long as the option is there for people to be able to go ahead and say what they like and have a conversation around certain parts, or take a little bit out of something on iPlayer and embed it in a blog post or whatever, then that's kind of the way it's moving forward, I think. Anyway.
Would you like to add anything to that?
Yeah, we were discussing the idea of almost sort of entertainment versus factual as well, and the fact that social media probably is more to offer the factual side of things than maybe entertainment, in terms of certainly in terms of real time tweeting and discussion. So as programs air, people can discuss, and we're discussing the idea of how programs can have a much wider impact than just physical people actually watching, because someone will be watching the show, they'll start a conversation possibly with the people presenting it, but then other people not watching the show will join in with that conversation as well, so you have the sort of that amplified ripple effect sort of, so which I mean, so possibly that might not happen so much with entertainment, you know, in terms of EastEnders or something, because people would be just watching it without necessarily interacting with it. But isn't that
because maybe there's not a platform for them to have that discussion and get involved?
Yeah, possibly, but I think also it's a mindset. When you're watching things like EastEnders or Corrie or whatever, you tend to get lost in the show, and you're sort of sat back, relaxed, wanting to be entertained mindset, and to then start having a conversation about it, it requires you to break your concentration away from the show, which may be a half an hour section. In the A, you might miss, you know, you might worry that you're missing something, and B, you just lose the flow of the show. So I think whereas stuff like, you know, News 24 or Top Gear or something like that, where it's small bite-sized chunks, where you might get to the end of the segment and you might go, what, you know, what was that about? I didn't get it. Or, you know, did you see that car? That was fantastic. And the show's still going on, but the discrete section has ended. It's sort of saying about breaking down to bite-sized chunks. So as soon as you've got to the end of that discrete section, you can then move on, you know, you can start discussing it.
Interestingly enough, it sounds a bit like one is about the suspension of disbelief which you get when you're reading a book and you're all consumed, which is the Corrie EastEnders experience, and the other one is more the realism and factual television that enables you to enjoy the conversation. Yeah. Is that something that you also experience, thinking?
The feeling I have, we were talking about the fragmentation of television. So we had this idea of the history of TV being broadcast medium. And as we begin to see it in a slightly different way, just because we've got computers, we play games, it breaks that concentration up in a different sort of way. So even now we're beginning to see TV in a different way. Not just as something you're going to work the next day and have a conversation about, but something you want to do something with as well. So you go into YouTube, use YouTube to look at it, break little fragments of TV, you put it up, you go to Twitter and Twitter about it, you write about it to someone in an email. So there's many, many ways of breaking the media down into a fragmented media. So in a way, we begin to construct a new social, in a way, and the social's happening on the internet. It's not just happening in everyday life, in the office, in the college. So there is a sense of that going on. But where that's going is another question. So who knows how that will... My interest will be in that beginning to break down and be remade into a learning environment of some sort. What that might mean, I don't know at the present time. So that's where my head's at around this.
Did you want to say anything as well?
I don't know if anybody ever mentioned this one, but one of the things we talked about was if you make things available in whatever way, I may have even said this just now in the other conversation, if you make things available in ways people can do with them whatever they want, they will come up with new things. And, yeah, that fit in with a lot of the other stuff we're talking about. I think, yeah, you and I already talked about that earlier on. Just that, yeah, if you make things available in interesting ways, it will come up with new things, and then you can use those ideas yourself if you want to, but yeah, it all feeds back in.
Brian Noonan,
Mark Jones,
James Watley,
Amanda Gore.
So we started talking about the future of online video advertising and how that could be done tastefully if you were showing, for instance, a report on the situation in Gaza. And then we moved into a Catch-22 situation where how can you get advertisers to buy into this new technology if the new technology isn't proven yet. That's kind of semantically linked content on DVDs and video. You've got more notes than me.
Did you reach any conclusions?
Ideas rather than conclusions, I think, on how you can create, you know, value for different areas from the content. So how people could be involved in it rather than advertising on it, and how you could have brands or organisations who become involved in content without having to push product. But then also looking at using the platform itself to allow both sides of the argument to be heard, and kind of spreading the content in different ways.
Is there any one example that you came to light when you were discussing that?
I think it's more of a wish list. It's what we perceive the next series of steps in the future, what we would like to see in place, or what each of us are working towards trying to achieve.
There's a theoretical example that you might be able to find an aid agency that had created a sort of compelling piece of video, say for Gaza, and you could use a clickable object within the video to take people off to a kind of call to action. So that'd be one way in which that might work.
One point was that there is so much information on the web, some of it very good, but actually how does the average person find that? Because there are no clear guidelines in places that the average person would look to find content such as TED, for example. So what could be done to create and define systems to help people find good content?
Access it, yeah.
Anything else?
I think we were also talking about the quality of TV and what people sort of like define as good quality, both visually and from a content perspective. And I think people's definitions of quality visually are going down because of the formats that they watch it on, and they're much happier to watch things on smaller screens. So quality in production value, sorry, production and how things look may be less important, but quality of content is still always going to be really important, we think.
Anything else?
But going along with that last point was also that make things available such that people can do what they want with them. I mean, so people can consume the information in what way they want. So everything from big screen down to small screens, people playing around with the content, extracting more value from it than the producer may have even originally imagined.
So. Even thought, yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're constrained by their own imagination, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. To my observations, there's no EPG for the new video media.
These intelligent people had a better view than me, but
I'm sure they didn't. No, you're all equals here.
We seem to have a lot of really interesting discussions. The one that really got me was when is the appropriate time to get upset with other people for looking at their devices or interrupting you? And I know he's called Cowfish. I'm still sending the real name. I Twitter name first. Billy made the good observation of if you're at the cinema and someone starts talking, clearly that's not appropriate. But I've come across family and friends who think I'm rude because I'm on my phone or my laptop, but I'm actually listening like we do.
Yeah.
But there were lots of other equally interesting conversations. So not enough time.
I won't say the obvious that you're male and multitasking.
Exactly. Male and multitasking.
I can,
that's the general criticism.
I can talk and hold a coffee at the same time. I can't drink it at the same time.
No,
so maybe
fair
I can't
enough,
multitask.
Fair enough. Can I just get you to say your name for the conversations of your conclusions are from
Annie Mole.
Janet Parkinson.
Free Cloud. I'm Billy Abbott, Cowfish.
Action Lamb.
Thank you very much.
We were talking about
the future of video conversation, and that those conversations, a lot of them are already taking place, either, you know, one-on-one on voice over IP, or responding to somebody's initial video on YouTube, often in a defamatory manner.
We've kind of spanned everything from Fred's and seismic style conversations to sort of YouTube threading to companies using video conferencing instead of and the environmental reasons why that's. So we've really had a fairly wide ranging conversation, and I think one of the things that certainly we've been saying is that this stuff is going to become a lot easier and a lot less geeky as the technology moves to the point where it's any content on any device without users actually having to do much to enable that, and it all happens automatically. And the fact that this stuff can now be indexed as well, as efficiently as text, or maybe not as efficiently as text, but soon those kind of technologies will be able to index audio from video conversations and even video, what the pictures are doing.
Yeah, and so then you're finding the interesting stuff because it's indexed.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
It's a lot about ROI, didn't we? Yeah. And how brands that want to use user-generated online video content, how the relationship works with the producers of that content. And we talked a bit about that from the brand perspective, but also from the user that's generating the content from their perspective as well. I think the conclusions that we reached was that there will always be content freely created, and that brands shouldn't try and expect people to work within their agenda. I think
to weirdly summarise, the whole point is that there is a massive expectation gap between the content providers, the content creators, and the people who want to use that content, driven by this kind of whole approach to everything on the internet is theoretically free, and that $14 entertainment for $4 kind of model. And I think that's basically what we were coming to on that point of view, is that expectation gap has to be addressed in some way. And normally the problem is whoever's got the money isn't prepared to pay as much money. The old business problem is not prepared to pay as much money as the people who own it think it's worth. So it does come down to a negotiation problem. It's essentially where we ended up.
Would you like to add anything?
Yeah, I mean, we were started out, I think, trying to talk about...
what you hijacked by Alex?
No. We weren't quite sure what our topic meant, but it was talking about linear video and what's the future of linear video. We spent quite a while actually trying to understand and define what linear video was. And I think we came to the conclusion-ish that it was about people deciding how they wanted to watch things and whether they could skip about in what they were watching. And I think we found that, you know, from a normal broadcasting sense, that's like more or less impossible, because the technology isn't really there at the moment. From an online perspective, it's sort of there, but still not. So we sort of, like, I think lost a little bit of track on what that whole linear or non-linear thing was for the future. But it's interesting if, you know, other people have got thoughts on what they think linear video is.
I think that's the point. It's trying to work out what the definition of that term was the problem. And, you know, I think there's some fundamental philosophical problem with the concept of linear video, because if you're talking about a linear narrative, that's not necessarily the same thing as a linear video approach, because video can only ever be linear. You are experiencing a time-driven media by progressing through time, and, you know, you can skip about in it, but that doesn't change the nature of the viewing experience. If you're talking about the experience, it's different to talk about the content. And they made the arguments that, say, for example, a news program would effectively be 7 stories that are in order, but that's not a linear narrative. It's a linear experience of experiencing it, and you can chop about through it however you want, which is what the editors have essentially done. But the narratives themselves still stand alone as linear elements and have to work in that way. So there needs to, you know, that question was a bit subject was a bit tricky, because it required a stretch your brain to understand what the questioner meant by the term linear television.
There's also, though, come to think of it, on something like Quip, which we've talked about earlier, the way that your videos are displayed on Quip is in a timeline, isn't it? It's a very linear fashion. It doesn't mean that you have to watch them in order. I wonder about the value of videos going back, you know, the ones that are over the page, or, you know, you have to scroll back. What value do they hold if they aren't immediate? You know, the immediacy of online video, I think, is really important at the moment. It's really significant.
But that, in terms of the conversation, becomes quite interesting anyway, because you get the situation whereby, you know, and we mentioned the Big Brother thing earlier on, and editing and organisating a conversation that way. If we have a conversation that's recorded, like the one you're recording just now, it's very easy to change the meaning by taking individual quotes and changing the context by changing the order. So if you are, again, talking about a linear narrative problem, which I think is the issue, it's not, you know, video as a narrative is where it gets tricky. If you're talking about a linear narrative problem, then viewing it in a non-linear form is arguably very dangerous anyway. If you're not viewing its original in your form, you're misrepresenting the argument, the discussion, the value that it has in the first place. So I think, yeah, it's a tricky problem.
Can I just ask a name? So I know you've done it before, but it just helps if people want to know who you are that we're talking about. It's Alex.
Hi, I'm Alex.
Yeah, Annie Mole on Twitter.
I'm Jenny B on Twitter, B-double-E.
That's it.
That'll do.
Yeah, thank you.